Hi, I'm Justin John Doherty. My favourite film is Don't Look Now. I like it so much, I made a book about it. Welcome to the Podyssey. Cue the music.
Welcome to the Podyssey, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the greatest little independent cinema on the planet, The Odyssey in St Albans. This podcast is a partnership between The Odyssey Cinema and Mix 92.6 FM, Hertfordshire's local radio station. Thanks for joining us.
Hello and welcome to this month's edition of the Podyssey. We're back after a 1 month, I'm going to say, well-deserved break. Interestingly, delay in start to recording this Halloween episode because of some spooky technical noises which we couldn't get to the bottom of. I hope they were technical anyway. I'm here with Sam, Nick and Roberto, of course. Chaps, how you doing?
Doing good.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
So, chaps, what have we been up to at the cinema in the last month or so?
So we very recently had the first rendition of the new Odyssey Film Club. This is our new kind of initiative to get film fans of all ages in to watch a film, big classic film, and then have a nice chat about it afterwards. So the first film we showed was Vertigo, which was just last weekend. And it was so nice to have a load of big film fans all having a nice chat about a big classic film with a free coffee. We actually had a member of the audience who was a big expert in Vertigo in particular, and he'd seen it about 50 times. And so I kind of just got to kick back while he chatted about it in great detail, which was excellent for me. And yeah, very informative for everyone else as well. And yeah, it was really lovely and highly recommend coming to join if that sounds good to you. And the next one will be Night of the Living Dead, just in time for Halloween. And we'll be doing it every Saturday, every last Saturday of the month.
Excellent. So Night of the Living Dead for Halloween, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. And speaking of Halloween, we've got a spooky watch-along to discuss a bit later. We all had a look at Don't Look Now. And we're going to have an expert in our midst. We've got Justin John Doherty, who's written a book. Not only has he made some films, he's written a book about Don't Look Now. We'll be talking to him about that and asking him some of the things that I didn't understand about that film. Roberto, what have you been up to?
Yeah, just the usual, I'd say. But definitely had some great experiences in the last couple of months in terms of related to film and The Odyssey. I think I've definitely seen my favourite film of the year, which is Weapons, which is a horror film. So if you do want to try and seek that out, do that. I thought it was absolutely great. Really lived up to my expectations. Been going quite wild on The Odyssey social media. Me and Sam putting together some sketches and some social media videos. We've got one up there for Harakiri, which we're showing tonight. I'm doing a slightly extended speech tonight. Fortunately,
is this the samurai film?
It is, yes. Yeah, and probably my favorite film as well. I wish I could say come tonight, but obviously this will go out afterwards. But no, it happened, and there's a video you can go watch. And there's also a great Downton Abbey sketch you can go and watch that me and Sam did. I've never actually seen Downton Abbey, but I took it upon myself to write a sketch about it. And, you know...
Are you sure you've not seen it? it's convincing. I've heard some good reviews.
How have you avoided this? I feel like I've seen it loads and I don't even like it that much.
Genuinely, I've only seen one clip from the entire series. Okay. I mention it in the sketch, so go and have a look at that. But yeah, no, just been plugging along, but been having a good time and glad to have us all back here.
Yeah, feels good.
Yeah.
I agree. We're on a Monday morning, which feels kind of quite lively and business-like. I like it.
A bit professional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nick, how you been?
Yeah, pretty well. I've been working quite a bit due to the Downton audiences, the Roses audiences that we've been having, doing very well, of course, for the British local audience. I really loved the National Theatre Inter Alia that we had, which starred Rosamund Pike. I think that was on like a week ago or so from now. But we do have one more coming up in November as well. Just a really... well-performed, well-produced play, sort of about like the justice system, but also juggling sort of parent life and your relationships with, you know, your family and things like that. It's such a well-written, put-together piece that I definitely recommend people go and see. The screening that I was in was sold out, and it got a huge round of applause afterwards as well. Like, you don't really need to, not being in the theatre, but that's how really good it was. And I think everyone felt the same way. We were just talking about it, talking after the performance. So check it out if you haven't. If you like any of the National Theatre films that are on the slate, we're likely to have them. So check them out. And it's much cheaper than going to the actual theatre and watching it. You can come watch it at a fraction of the price and with a cheese plate.
Nice. And you can't say fairer than that. Right, nice one, chaps. So we're going to take a quick break there while I try and investigate this annoying technical noise. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about Don't Look Now, which I watched and is I watched on a sunny afternoon, which felt really like juxtapositionizing. Is that a word? Yeah. But basically, it felt like the wrong thing to watch on a sunny afternoon because that is good and very, very dark. And for Halloween, pretty spooky as well. So we'll be talking about that with Justin John Doherty, who's going to join us right after this break. Welcome back to part two of the Podyssey. And apologies if you heard the odd little bleeping noise in that one. You know, the sort of thing that sounds like somebody getting an email or a drive and popped out. We couldn't quite work out what it is. So you've had to sit through it. We think we've sorted it now, though, which is just as well, because listen up and sit straight at the back. We've got a guest in. So everybody on best behaviour. Justin, you are with us because you've written a book about Don't Look Now, called Don't Look Now and Then. Justin John Doherty is with us. He's an author and a filmmaker and a general man who knows a lot about films. He's written a book on Don't Look Now called Don't Look Now and Then. Justin, thank you for joining us here on the Podyssey. It's great to have you with us. He's excited to have a guest.
Well, you are my local cinema as well, so it's kind of, you know, it's good. It's the one I try to get to.
Oh, nice. And you've made us all very nervous and you've made us all prepare and come in on a Monday morning and try and be a bit more professional than we normally are.
I see a lot of questions on pads and so I'm hoping they feel like I am now underprepared.
So you're joining us because every month we do a watch along of a film. This month, because it's Halloween, we were looking at Don't Look Now, and you have written a book about Don't Look Now, as we spoke about. So can you tell us a bit about the book and also why this film?
Well, so the sort of why this film is quite easy. It is my favourite film of all time. You know, as film guys, film lovers, you know, you have lists that you build, you know, and it's the thing people always ask you about, what's your favourite film, when they find out you like films. And so it just emerged as, it just became my favourite in that sort of shorthand. But it really was, as I was getting into filmmaking and sort of going from being a film-loving teenager to sort of trying to think about whether I could actually make films and how that would come together, I was shown that film and it sort of blew my mind. And it was the first film that I really remember teaching me, you know, how you could have that power over an audience with the manipulation of images. You know, what you show in the first few minutes could also be, you know, shown again in the last few minutes and sort of help you tie things together. A bit like the way Nolan does now in all his films. He does this same sort of technique of sort of, you know, weaving these things which you don't understand, but then you get them reframed in a different position later on in the film and you're going to go, oh, that makes sense. So having that revelation of like, oh, this is what you can do with editing and cinematography was just, you know, mind-blowing to me. And then And obviously it's got a shocking ending. It's got a very famous love scene. So to watch that as a teenager, it's quite an impactful thing, you know. And then it has stayed with me through my life and at different stages of life. When I've revisited it, it's always done something different for me. It's a different film now. I'm a parent, quite rightfully. The opening scene, it's a different film now. I'm married, because it's really a great film about marriage. When I was younger, it was a film that was about just, it was a yarn, you know, it was cool, it had cool editing, it was really different, and it was just like a, you know, it's kind of hokum on one level, you know, but now it's a film about grief, it's a film about marriage, it's got all these other layers to it. So, you know, that's sort of why. And the book, why the book is just, you know, I'm a filmmaker first and foremost, and I delve into other projects. And I did an exhibition years ago at a film festival I used to run, and I'd just taken pictures of Venice then and now, you know, and it's where the title comes from of the book. And Nicholas Roeb, the director, came to that exhibition because we were screening his latest film at the time, which was Puffball, which was his last film. And the exhibition really tickled it, you know, and just he liked the obsession. He liked the fact that time, you know, he loved time, Nicholas Roeb, and the sort of manipulation of time. And so he loved the fact that Venice hadn't changed, but something had, like maybe a poster on a wall or just, you know, something that's pasted to a wall and or things like that. And so he sort of flippantly said, oh, there's a book here somewhere. And then I sort of didn't do anything with that really. I couldn't see the shape of that book for years. And I went off and I did other things. I made films and built a jazz club and did all these different things. And at the end of it, I was thinking, oh, I feel really far away from movies again. You know, I haven't made anything in a while. And I was seeing all these lovely books. I'd always go around and see these beautiful coffee table books about great films, you know. Remember seeing one about Once Upon a Time in the West and thinking, oh, this is a beautiful book. Oh, why isn't there one about Don't Look Now? Oh, maybe I should make one about Don't Look Now. That's the long answer to the question.
Yeah, no, it's a great answer. And we saw the book just before we came on air. The book looks amazing.
Witty, like, you know?
You've got kind of stills of nobody. Exactly, yeah, yeah. If you're wearing a red hood, you're a mad old lady.
Yeah.
You've got kind of stills that like nobody's seen before and this kind of thing. How was that process?
Yeah, well, I started sort of working out whether there was enough material because, you know, 52 years ago, the film was made, you know, when I started the project. And, you know, I keep a lot of things, but not everyone does. And I was, how much is there? How much archive is there? Is there anything? Are there annotated scripts and things like that? And it was a little low, you know, at the beginning. And I thought, I was sort of in the project by then. I thought, I'll have to do something else with the book. So I started to talk to other people who I knew loved the film, like Brett Goldstein and producer Stephen Woolley, and sort of said, you know, oh, you love this film. Will you, you know, write something? Will you contribute? And they were like, yeah, you know, we'll do something. But then about halfway through, I found through a photographer who worked on the film when he was 19. It was his first job. He had... unusually, very unusually for a film photographer, because you don't keep the negatives from the film shoot. It belongs to the studio. He had the negatives, which had been saved from an archive, which was going to get incinerated.
Wow. Basically.
And then again, time goes and these things get forgotten. And then so suddenly I went from having a little bit of material to having 3,000 negatives to scan and look through and like gold, like a literal gold mine of just putting a negative in a scanner and being like, what's coming up? And you're watching the lines kind of going as it scans and you're like, it's not a good picture. It's a great picture. And then I had this, wealth of material and these different people who wanted to write for it. Because it's a lot of people's favorite films who make films. And so, you know, Danny Boyle, Steven Soderbergh, a lot of people love this movie. And so it was quite easy to kind of talk my way into places.
You want to write my book? Film people love chatting about films, I guess. Oh, that's...
yeah. And Reese Shearsmith, who does Inside Number 9.
Yeah.
He ended up doing the foreword for the book.
Well, he loves a kind of spooky vibe as well, right?
And he was great. He just like was so up for it because it's just, people love it. And so there's lots of these love letters throughout the book of people. I just sort of said to people, pick your favorite, you know, frame or scene or whatever it is. I don't know. And just write a little thing about it. If you're in the back of a cab, whatever, just write it down and send it. And but people did some really nice, thoughtful things because I didn't want it to be about this is why Justin likes Don't Look Now. It's not really, I mean, who cares?
It's about the film, is it? Yeah, standing alone. Yeah,
the film. I call it a glorified scrapbook, ultimately, pulling all these bits together that are interesting for me. So when you get the book, it's like you get to search through a box file of stuff and you get to go, that's to do with that and that links to that, and just finding everyone else who was still alive really who could talk about it. And a lot of people have passed away because it's so long ago, and some people were still around, including one of the film's producers who I found about 4 miles from this studio where I was. After going around the world to see other people, I then found him finally, and living in Harpenden.
That's great.
It's very strange. So it was great to meet him and talk about him. And he'd worked with Orson Welles a couple of times. It's the first time I'd bumped into anyone who lived and worked with Orson Welles.
Wow.
Pretty interesting guy.
That's amazing.
That's funny because when the film finished on my rewatch this time, right at the end of the credits, it said it was filmed, parts of it were filmed in Hertfordshire. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. The opening scene of the house is over towards Broxbourne area, in Hertfordshire. So, and that's one of the favourite location I found, you know.
Yeah.
I go back there whenever they'll have me. It's a totally private house, and so, but I've got to know them quite well and they tolerate me. But they're the same family who owned that since the time it was filmed.
Really?
They were around when it was filmed, and the headmaster in the film, who plays the headmaster of the boys' school, he was the owner of that house.
Oh, no way.
Uncle David Tree. He was an actor in the 30s. And then during the war, he was injured in the war and retired when he came back from the war. It became, you know, champion farmer and was always involved in the arts. The family, a very arts-based family. And so, yeah, when Nick Rogue went to the location and sort of saw it was him, he sort of said, oh, will you play this small part in the film? So he came out of retirement to do that little cameo.
Oh, that's excellent. So I'll tell you what, we're going to take a quick break there and then we're going to be discussing Don't Look Now, because we all had a bit of a watch of it and I have got a lot of questions that aren't in this film. So we'll be back in a second. Okay, welcome back to the Podyssey. And as I say, apologies if you're hearing the odd bleepy noise. You're having the odd technical issue, which we can't quite iron out, but we will work on that. And I'm hoping somebody will produce this well enough that you won't hear it and wonder what I'm talking about when you listen. But we are back for our Halloween watch-along, which this month is Don't Look Now. Justin's in with us, as you've just heard. Justin's an expert on this film. We've all watched it. Chaps, so I'll go first, just because I'll have probably the least exciting input on this. Thought it was amazing. Watched it on a sunny afternoon in the day, which was such a weird, you know, outside life is going on in my house. This terror is unfolding. Thought it was great. Thought it was mad. I think we can do a spoiler alert on a film that's this old.
Say, can we talk about it?
Yeah, so
that
we'll
end is truly like, what is going on there? Who is that? The end is absolutely horrendous. But I really enjoyed it. It was mad. I won't rush to watch it again because I found it a very unsettling experience. Didn't feel great after it, but incredible bit of filmmaking. We'll go this way around. Nick, what did you make of it?
I'm to be honest, I feel similar to you. Like I sat there and watched it. It was very unsettling. I'd call it experimental. I feel like it is very experimental when it's in that. I feel like it has taken a lot of influences and sort of gotten to like expand on that. I felt like a lot of Hitchcock in it, with the sort of use of like plain objects like glass and water and things like that to like show reflections of reflections that maybe you can sort of see, but also that sort of thing where it's like, am I looking straight or am I seeing double, that sort of thing, you know.
And a bit like him in the film, a bit like Donald Sutherland, as you're watching bits, he's watching bits and he's not seeing them either. Do you know what I mean? There's that one particular bit where it turns out that he's having a vision, I think. So a lot of it is around kind of sight, what people are seeing, what you're seeing. It is mad.
It also unsettles you more because you sort of have the beautiful location of Venice and then it makes it so dark. Gordy's right, really claustrophobic alleys in Venice as well, which they clearly have used enough to be like, you know, we're going to sort of create tension around this thing. And you said the distant sort of like hallucination or visions that he has that just make that character, you know, Don Sutherland's character, just you're looking at it, you're like, you're going like stir crazy, essentially. And I think that's also, again, that's another like Hitchcock influence, that man just going nuts and sort of like trying to figure out what's going on with his family. I have my notes here.
Well, the Hitchcock, I think, obviously, it's based on a short story by Daphne du Maurier, which of course Hitchcock, did a few things.
The Birds and Rebecca, right?
So there is that sort of line between them that you can draw.
It's very interesting. This is actually my second time watching Don't Look Now, and the first time I watched it was at the Odyssey, and this is chiefly my main kind of experience. First time watching it was I watched it right next to my mum. I was planning to go watch it by myself and she suddenly went, oh, I kind of want to watch that. I was like, okay, let's go. And then the person in the speech brought up the famous love scene that you brought up. And I was like, right, well, you know, we're here now. But weirdly enough,
only 3.5 minutes, really intense 3.5 minutes with your mum.
It was really interesting. This time rewatching it, that scene felt longer than it was the first time. Maybe the first time I was just doing this, I was going like,
yeah, the sex scene is long
but very effective, I think. And also in keeping with the rest of the film's like editing style, which to get onto that, I think it was interesting rewatching this because the first time I watched it, it was definitely like a very hypnotic experience, I would say. And then this time, sometimes when you rewatch a film that is like quite visceral on your first watch, it almost feels like the second watch doesn't have that same, you know, punch to it. But I've this is my metric of like how locked in I was on this film. I usually like have a few drinks or snacks like set out before I watch a film. I watched the film, I didn't pause it at all, and the film finished, and I was like, right, time to get ready for bed. And I turned around and my Oreos that I'd laid out were still there. I like hadn't touched them. I was like completely transfixed the entire time. And I think it is because they use such simple they use what are like very traditional editing and camera techniques to create this kind of the idea of a second sight, I suppose, as it's said in the film. They use like just when he sees the boat with his wife on, it's just as though that boat is like cut right next to it. They don't have to use, you know, they don't have to pull out any fancy after effects. There are some like after effects in the film, obviously, but they mostly rely on in-camera techniques that really make the fantastical elements of the film feel grounded and translate that experience to the audience like so well. I think it's like really interesting how kind of all in camera this film is, and obviously one of the major parts being Venice is such a important part to this film's hypnotic quality.
It also adds to like an element of like it's almost like a dream.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, dreamlike sort of sequences. Also, you know, you get these visions and so on. I think a lot of the, I don't know if it was just purely the weather, but, you know, the haziness of it and the sort of like cloudy effects that you feel like you get in camera as well.
And Venice is empty at that point. You know, they're shooting in the winter in Venice, and it's not the, and we're all familiar with Venice now because of, you know, we've seen it a million times.
Yeah.
When this film comes out, you know, unless you've been to Venice, you know, or, you know, hadn't been that many films set in Venice to this degree, so you're in a strange place. So and so Donald Sutherland's in this strange place which you can't understand, and the sounds in Venice come from different places, right, where you expect them to. Anywhere near water, sounds reflect and bounce off buildings, so everything about it is, I mean, it all goes back to, you know, what you're sort of saying about, has he had a vision, what is it, you know. Nick Rogue's theme for this film is, it's a throwaway line at the beginning, that it's nothing is what it seems. That's the throwaway line that Donald Sutherland says in the opening scene. It's sort of like the crux of the movie, you know.
Yeah.
And Nick had said that to Donald. He'd said, like, this is, you know, you're going to say the whole theme of the movie. And then it drove him crazy. And they did, like, loads of takes because he was putting too much emphasis on it.
Yeah.
The end, he just sort of says, oh, nothing's what it seems. Because he's only answering a question to his wife, who's asking about the frozen pond at the beginning. Yeah. Question the kid had, you know. But that is the film, you know, nothing is what it seems. And it's right, you know, it shouldn't be. I mean, these days, they would, if someone was having a vision, they would, I don't know, zoom into the eyes, there'd be some effects, you know, we kind of like the camera would swirl around so we know we're having this sort of experience. Ooh. Whereas in that, you can't tell what it is because he can't tell. So the simplistic element.
I've been interested in your take on this, Jessica. I've got a few questions and also a few things that I just want to say so you think, oh, well spotted. So a bit of this is me looking to South Bella. So I feel like Donald Sutherland's character is psychic in this, but doesn't really believe in all that, so doesn't know he's psychic.
Yeah. I think he's in denial, isn't it?
And his wife's really interested in that kind of side of it.
Yeah, and this, you know, the blind sister thinks, you know, she recognises it immediately, but he's sceptical of it. I mean, on the surface of it, it's a really simple film, isn't it? You know, you've got, you know, a couple are grieving. They're in Venice. They're warned to leave Venice. And all the time we're seeing these murders happen. We see it. They, you know, he almost witnesses one. He sees someone in a red hood. That's not a vision. That's just another narrative that's happening at the time. The police, you know, we see a body coming out of the canal. When it's actually shouldn't be a surprise at the end, when it's just a terrible coincidence, you know?
Yeah.
Because he has ignored the warnings because he refuses to believe that he might have second sight. Why does he get up at the beginning and go into the garden?
Massively, yeah, that's where we get the little clue, right? Because first of all, obviously, we have the kind of blur on the stained glass, which is amazing. But yeah, he knows what's happening
something
down by the pond.
And is it just parental instinct or is it something else? You know, that's the question. That's the first little jab at you to be like,
yeah.
Nothing is what it seems. There's not, this is not a normal situation.
Also, I am... I think two things I would slightly judge Donizano's character for. One is mad to go to Venice. So it's all happening in water. It's a, you know, you've not had a good time with water lately.
I didn't think that. I was like,
Venice feels like a bit of a trigger warning, pickery place to go. Also, as a parent myself, not into judging other parents, slightly loose at the beginning. The kids are just by this massive freezing lake. They're inside reading a book. Come on.
The guy's just playing in the garden.
Yeah.
It's sort of like panes of glass is strewn on the grass as well.
Yeah, very, very strange. So, Sam, what did you make of it?
It was my second time seeing it as well. So it was interesting to revisit and kind of approach it from a different angle. I think what definitely struck out to me this time was the edit, like you were talking about earlier, and how, there's loads of match cuts and that kind of thing, and everything feels very tied together. And everything that happens later on is kind of just a mirror image of what has already happened. Like the way that people die is kind of just like a repeat, or it's like that's been precedented by what's already happened. So it kind of feels like you were saying, Nick, like a dream. And there's like a dream logic that's kind of operating throughout it, because obviously there's the second sight aspect to it. But the way it's all edited together, you're getting like, for we as the audience are getting like foresight of what's happening next before it's happened. Like during the love scene, you're cutting into the next scene as it happens as well. So it's like, the film's kind of caught up in its own futurity, I guess.
Well, there's the ultimate example of that in the edit, which just I think it's amazing. It's so simple. It's just an amazing bit where he's gone up the scaffolding in the church.
Yeah.
And he's doing something, and it just feels ominous, doesn't it? It just goes. There's no soundtrack at this point. It's just creaking and bits and pieces, and then you see that beam fall. We see that plank of wood fall, and we see it a few seconds before, and then there's a delay. Isn't there, between it crashing? It's like we get let into this secret for a moment that we know more than anyone else at this point, and then it happens. And I love that. I love that playing with time.
Yeah, that's cool.
Rogue love playing with time. And that
sort of gives the viewer also the sense that they might have seen something that they are expecting, obviously, like, or seeing something later on. And I think that's sort of brought up more towards the end as well with the psychic part. And I was going to mention quickly, because I know you mentioned that weapons was one of your
favorite. Oh, yeah.
And I was looking up some behind the scenes or like crew details. And the lady who played the blind sister has been in a TV show called something about Robin Hood and the Merry Men. And she gave me Gladys vibes from weapons. And she played a lady called Gladys in this TV show.
Oh, you're
really just like,
That's really interesting you mentioned that, because I was about to say about those two characters in particular, they stuck out to me a lot on the rewatch, because they're always like treading the line between are they sinister or are they actually genuinely really sweet? And obviously I think at the end of the film you find out like their intentions are like pretty purely good.
It's clever that they're kind of nice older ladies, because they seem so unthreatening, but the bit where the blind sister kind of imitates the sex scene is one of the most horrific bits of film I've ever watched. That is so unsettling. You know the bit I mean, right?
Yeah, in the hotel room, yeah.
Yeah, which is like
in the seance.
Yeah.
In the seance.
So she's basically talking about how their daughter is there with them, she's happy. She's happy. She's happy, kind of thing. Then she breaks off a bit and she starts mimicking the sex scene we've watched.
Well, I didn't know if that's what that was.
We've never seen it as that.
Oh, okay.
I might we're going in work too, or a couple of weeks. I just thought that was how her expression was through, whatever pain was coming through the seance, whatever she was seeing.
Oh, that's okay. Interesting. Because I took that she was, I see everything kind of thing. So I felt like she was kind of almost mimicking how they, some of the wording from the sex scene. Oh, maybe I've got that wrong.
No, I don't know.
And if I've got that wrong, that is a weird thing to pick up.
Interpretation.
It's interpretation. Speaking you're in therapy, book. Right? No, that's a really interesting thought about it. Because I've often thought that sexualization of that seance scene is really kind of like off-putting, you know?
No, oh, it's horrible.
What she's doing. She, yeah. You know, that character is just, to me, it's like a kind of tick she develops in that whatever energy is flowing through her. I've all sort of seen it as that. But obviously we're, as people who can see, we apply something different to it. She wouldn't have that as an application.
But it's great. And also it really works, you know, on our Halloween theme. Like it is just out and out. There's some wicked, just proper scary horror bits, right? So, again, spoiler alert, but it's very old. You should watch it anyway, even if you haven't.
It made me laugh, though. The
actual wearer of the red hood is just hideously terrifying. Like, when she turns around, that's one of the most terrifying people I've ever seen.
Oh,
no?
I think...
What? With a knife? An old lady with a knife?
Okay, I'm pretty scary.
That is absolutely
fever, yeah. I think, I was talking to our colleague Mikey yesterday, because he was saying, oh, you're going to watch it, oh, it's going to be scary. He mentioned, and I think I've seen a few readings that bring up Giallo as kind of an influence on it, which is obviously like Italian horror slasher films that are like very high on the kind of, you know, it's not just someone gets stabbed and they die, it's like they get stabbed, the blood streams for like ages. Obviously there's the Italian setting, but I think this film's interesting in terms of like, it's almost like, it's like you said how there's another narrative happening. It's like there's a giallo happening elsewhere. We're seeing this like one side of the story, and then only at the end do we realize, oh, this is a giallo, because yeah, the violence is so, it's like one of the only like few bits of like, you know, human on human violence you see in the film. And it is like, so it just, as soon as it hits, the ending didn't have, rewatching it, the ending didn't lose its impact at all. Like, I still felt like, and I was thinking when she turned around, I was like, maybe I imagined maybe the first watch of the film, I imagined it, and maybe it is going to be his daughter this time.
And there's like a little shake of the head there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really, yes. Yeah, getting that.
That's amazing. So, okay, I'm into this because I thought that was really wicked and also terrifying and also a really interesting bit. Do you think that's a bit like, you've been warned?
Well, because he sort of says, wait, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's so horrifying.
Before or after, but yeah, he's like, wait. Yeah. Because, yeah, the timing of this is all quite, like, it's sort of pulled out, but then it's also really quick, you know, again, that timing's played around with. And just the sound of all that sound design.
Yeah.
So very analog sound design, which a lot of that was done by the editor, Graham Clifford, just sort of pulling sounds around, you know. That was like, almost like a child crying up in the... No, he just follows that child up.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, your take on this, Justin, do you think this is deliberate? There's some bits, so like, for example, you could argue that the sex scene does this, but there's certain bits all the way through the film where stuff happens for an uncomfortably long time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
So like, there's bits that you just want them to end and they're just not ending.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I feel like it's, he like, does that on purpose.
Text, which kind of go, which like, he stays on for a few more beats than you'd expect.
Yeah, and you sort of, what it makes you
suddenly around the bishop as well. There are moments with the bishop.
He's an older guy.
Where you're a bit not quite sure what the bishop's motivations are with it, whether he really cares about the church anyway. I think that's Donald's frustration with him. But also there's that bit where after that falling scene and the scaffolding, you know, the bishop's really weird. He sort of walks away.
Yeah.
But then you hear later, he says, oh, my father was killed in a fall.
Oh.
So, okay, all right. You sort of put these things to bed as they go, but they unsettle you.
And yeah.
Put to bed. And sometimes they're not put to bed. And so you're still left wondering about that. But, I mean, the love scene is, go back to that thing we're talking about, the love scene being long. It is long. It's sort of like, if you take it out, the film doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because, you know... They're a bit bickery, aren't they, at points?
But they're still close, right?
Rogue was feeling like they're a bit bickery.
Yeah.
So he felt like there needed to be this moment where we really understand. And probably, potentially even that's the first time they've made love since the death of their child. There's kind of a hint to that, that there's been barriers. There's been, but having had that experience where she's fainted and the sisters said they've, you know, and she suddenly felt some release and she's happy. She saw Christine, the daughter, and she was happy. And suddenly Julie's character feels sort of a bit more open to intimacy.
Yeah.
So that's like, you know, I think that has to work. And that's, and like, when do we see married couples have sex in films? You know, that's like, it's really important. Like, it's all part of their entire relationship. It's like, we've learned so much about them in those three.
So true. And we then understand that despite the challenges, they're still in love. They're still tender. Yeah, I think that.
And also, it's kind of like, I love it because it's, you know, Julie Christie mentions this in the book a bit. Like, it's like really real. It's kind of messy, you know? It's not like love scenes. So beyond this point, you know, in movies, it tends to sort of like, you know,
gloss
it. Really gloss it up. Like, everyone's really amazing performers. It's just really like, it's all this. But actually, it's kind of messy. They're kind of almost falling off the bed at one point. They have to get back on the bed.
Yeah.
All of that sort of chopping, you know, and changing, it just feels really real. It reminds you of your own times, you know. And so I think that's really, it's powerful.
It's clever.
And they used to take it out on TV.
Interesting. Yeah. It was a different film without it, right?
Yeah, totally different film. But now it's a funny thing, you know, because it's, you know, it was very controversial at the time. But now the film passes as a 15 certificate. It's really interesting to you. How we go from X to B in these years and how no one even blinks when that's on now.
Yeah.
I know. I think it's a very, I agree. I think like that, it's probably like, it's like one of the clear, like non-gratuitous sex scenes in film that I've seen. And also like, I think I remember when this film came out, not when this film came out, when this film was kind of, in the zeitgeist around the time, I think Nicholas Roeg passed away, which was 2018 a bit, around that time. And I was watching another film podcast who watched at the time, and they brought up how the nudity in that scene is like, you don't really see that in cinema where like couples are just kind of in the nude together. And like, it's just because that is how you are like with a partner. You did, like, you know, the tears and
yeah, she's in the bar, he's on the way, and himself in the way, girl, dude, his teeth. It's all just very,
very domestic,
really natural way of, and also throughout the film, there's like plenty of times where you really feel the like the closeness of the couple, like the love between them, and that really, I think that is what makes the film resonate, because it's just so tragic at the end when he because it, I guess as well, and maybe this is my interpretation, obviously the Red Hood killer like is obviously supposed to bring back the image of his child wearing the red coat, and I always interpret it as like that's maybe him wanting to go back for his child and like bring her back almost. Maybe he sees like in saving this little girl, maybe he can like redeem himself for not saving his own daughter, and then so doing that in such good intention, and then for that just blow of fate to happen is just...
Yeah, well, I mean, the last line of the short story is, what a bloody silly way to die.
Acknowledges,
like, the irony, like, acknowledges that how silly it is. You know, he's ignored all these things. He's ignored all these signs. And now he's just, like, found himself in a place totally on his own and gets killed. You know,
and there's a bit of his... he's almost... been killed by his own, I'm not clear enough to know which one I mean, whether I mean skepticism or cynicism, but basically he doesn't believe his own psychic warnings, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's the fact that he refuses to believe that side of things exists is why he ends up dead, because he's ignoring some very clear warnings. Amazing. Sam, what else did you make of it?
I think... it kind of is confusing on purpose, which is really interesting. Like, the whole time you're kind of watching it, you're like, what is happening? What actually is any of, how much of this is real and how much of it isn't? I think it does a really good job of like putting you in Donald Sutherland's mind, and you're kind of like, obviously we're watching it as the audience, so we know more than he does, but you kind of have his sort of experience yourself as a viewer. Especially with like all the Italian actors are talking Italian and with no subtitles, and he's like stumbling through it and trying to communicate, but really struggling to.
And there's lots of, the communication he's having, you're just not quite sure what you could trust, because, you know, he's having a very sort of disjointed conversation with the policeman, isn't he, when he goes to finally see the policeman.
Yeah, he really does.
We were talking about that aside, like how off-putting that policeman is in that scene. And he didn't speak
a word of English.
Yeah.
So, like, that's all learned phonetically. It's this sort of real
It's a great performance.
Yeah.
Bernard's speaking.
Yeah. He's just doodling on his hands.
Yeah.
Doodling on a thing where you think he's writing stuff down. But he's also a creepy sod. Like, everyone he encounters is a bit of a shifty sod, aren't they? Like,
yeah, there's quite a few. But, or are they? Or is it just nothing's what to see?
Yeah.
Is he just, like, tired? There's a killer on the loose. And this guy's, like, had an argument with his wife and is coming in.
That's fair.
Looking at it the other way, you know. So he's just like, okay, another one of these. All right, when did you last see her? You know.
Yeah, that's fair.
And it's even interesting when he looks out the window and he sees two women, doesn't he, walking in the park outside the window.
It's, yes, yeah.
He's not like, there they are. He's just like, could it be?
Yeah, what might be, mate. Get out of my office. Yeah.
I like all that. Yeah, and the language... Again, it just keeps him totally... once she's gone back to England, he's totally isolated, isn't he? In it. So he's got no one to keep him... What he's seeing is he's got no one to sort of check against, does he? Because he's totally, like you say, sort of going a bit crazy, stir crazy, you know?
But yeah, truly unsettling, terrifying and amazing film. Anyone got any final points or any questions for Justin before we leave our watch-along discussion?
I think I just wanted to bring up how like crazy the stunt work was when he fell in the church. Actually,
I was thinking like how did they do that? Because it looks so he's literally like hanging on the rope and he's like trying to
He's hanging on a rope.
And also another thing I wanted to bring like there's an edit where after they see the body come out of the river, you see him like fall. You see a cut to him like falling. That really like. Unnerved me. I think it's like that idea.
Yeah, it's like it's less. You know, it's like 12 frames or something.
Yeah,
it's just and it got a little bit of sound with it as well. It's like like the sound of a fall.
Yeah, it's like you don't know. You see him fall out of frame, and it's like he could have. Maybe that was where he could have died. You don't know. And the only other thing I'd ask, actually, the church. We haven't really touched on the church aspect, but I wouldn't really be able to put an interpretation to like what it means in the grand scheme of things. But I thought it was really interesting. During the scene when he's killed and we're having, like, the flashbacks, do you notice the scene... You know when you're putting the statue up on the church and we see an edit to him kissing the statue? Or is it just he looks like he...
He's just, like... I think he's just, like, right round it. But it's a very similar positioning of him and the person in the red hood at the end.
Yeah,
in height. He's almost, like, come face-to-face with that gargoyle.
Her face. That's what I sort of presumed it was as well, because the face of the gargoyle he was putting up on stone is very, obviously, just an ugly face, and that's what he sort of presented with at the end. I feel like that was what... Like, he's almost, like, met that face before.
Yeah, oh, that's okay. That's
what I took from...
Also, after that fall, of course, he thinks he nearly died there, like, say.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, like... For him, that could be like, well, I mean, he even says it, doesn't he? You know, I was warned something might happen about this,
and now it happens.
Now it happens, so
and I'm okay.
Yeah.
Thinks he's dodged the bullets.
Yeah. I think this conversation has just illuminated how like this
different.
It's such a. I know what you call it. Like a
not even so layered.
You can look at it in so many different in ways.
I completely agree. Like even us just chatting about now, like it's an amazing. Piece of work. Like there's more layers than, you know, we've been chatting for nearly half an hour. There's more layers than we can even get into in this film. There's just so much going on.
Still, you know, it's 50 odd years old. It's great. It's great. It holds up and it finds, you know, new people because there's something of it. Although it is clearly a 70s movie, you know, when you look at certainly the British part of the shoot aesthetically, Venice doesn't age really. And kind of Sutherland and Julie's fashion sets actually has kind of almost come back round again in lots of ways. So there's sort of a timeless aspect to the Venice bits. But even though it's sort of that, at the time, we weren't really making films quite like that. There's nothing else quite like it, I think, tonally. I think the music adds to that, the score by Pino Donaggio.
The score is great.
Yeah. And that's his first film score.
Really happy that they had such an involvement from Italian creatives as well. Even the actor who plays the hotel manager is also in Cinema Paradiso.
Oh, he's the Nick's favourite film.
My favourite film.
He was a film critic, I think, originally. I think this guy, he ends up in these movies. He's very good at improvising.
Oh, yeah. Well, they had to have charismatic.
50%, exactly. Like, I mean, totally exactly. I talked to the producer in Harpenden about this. He said it was so difficult because you had to get the money. It had to be a co-production. And so, sure, 50-50, exactly. Not 51. And so that's why you end up having to, that person has to be Italian.
Yeah.
Because we've got, had an English person doing that. Why a lot of people in the English section of the film aren't credited? Till at the book, you know, I credit everyone I found a name for because, you know, like a lot of old movies, load of credits just don't make sure. It to the final slates. But yeah, because you just got to balance that bit. And the English one was really just a quick shoot. Like, there was an art designer that was never credited, quite a well-known art designer. Different people just coming to do the job. And then, because Venice was the main bit.
Yeah.
So in 4 days they did over here. But there was the girl in that pond in December, you know.
That happened, yeah.
You know, half a cheer in December, cold pond. That's,
oh, my God.
You say you don't let kids play around a pond. I mean... Yeah. Do you dip them in ponds?
Yeah. I'm not sure that would definitely be allowed.
It didn't go down well, and they actually shot that bit in the end in a slightly warmer water in a tank.
Like, that was good.
A big tank on that farm. Yeah. You can see a change in the... it works stylistically. You can see a change in the lighting when he pulls around in a slow motion.
So look, we're running out of time. We could do this all day, to be honest with you, but it must have been so cool for you to like love a film like that and then meet the people who helped make it, like chatting to that producer and stuff. That must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. Just going back to see, I finally got into where he dies, because you're not allowed to go to that room. Because in that palazzo, it's all restored now, except there's a very small room at the top of the palazzo, which is, it's not that structurally safe. It's very small, you know. You can only crawl in there but that is the only bit that hasn't been restored. There's a picture of it in the book I'll show you. But it's as is. And there's even some fake blood still on the producer, because it just never got restored, that bit.
Right.
So the Venetian Republic had to write letters to the Venetian museum directors, and finally they let me up there. And that was, you know, so just as I'm so geeky about it, so just as fun as meeting people involved in the film, just kind of, I like places and had a kick out of locations.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I always get, you know, that proximity of being near a place where something was filmed. That sort of excites the film guy in me, really.
That's great. And the book's called Don't Look Now and Then.
Yep.
And where can people get it?
You can get it if you go to the BFI, you get it at the BFI. It's also on my website, don'tlooknowbook.com. It will be out in other bookshops as and when, but it's sort of, I'm a one-man band. It's sort of getting out there.
Available in all good bookshops and some rubbish ones.
Yeah, if you ask your bookshop, they'll be able to source it for you very shortly.
Fantastic. Justin, it's been great having you in with us. Apologies that we had really little issues, but genuinely, thank you so much for coming in. It's been fantastic and it's been so interesting chatting to you. Thank you. We'll be back for a very, very short version of what's coming up at the Odyssey after this break. Right, welcome back to the final part of the Podyssey. Justin was nice, wasn't he? And what he knew a lot about that film. That was amazing. The book looks so good, didn't it?
Yeah, the book is amazing. Yeah, definitely check it out.
Yeah, amazing. What a good guest. Hopefully he'll come back and do some more films with us.
Get us to understand some films we don't understand.
Yeah. I like it. Everyone's on their best behaviour. Everyone had much better notes than normal. They're very serious questions. Yeah, it was good. Right, that was such a good chat with Justin that we went quite far over time on it, which is fine. We'll just try and be a bit quick, chaps. So if you can all just give me a couple of bits you're looking forward to. I know there's loads of spooky content and loads of Halloween-y films coming up this month, as you'd expect. But just give us two that you're particularly excited about. Sam, let's start with you.
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, Night of the Living Dead is the next Film Club film. So we'll be showing that on the 25th of October at 1 p.m. So if you fancy seeing a great classic film with a couple of film nerds around you as well, I'll be there. We can all have a nice chat after the film. So definitely come for that. We've also got Ridley Scott's classic Alien on the same day, actually, at 7 p.m. So if you fancy both, definitely come and do that. Also, just a quick mention to it's our 11th anniversary coming up, and we're doing, as we do every year, a surprise film to celebrate. That will be on the 3rd of November. So it's always a very glamorous, nice event, and there'll be a free glass of Prosecco along with your ticket.
And those are good events. Oh, yeah. I'm lucky enough to get invites to those. They're really good events. And the films are wicked. So the last few have been Wicked Little Letters and then Gladiator 2 last year, which was so exciting.
Yeah, which is in advance of when...
It's like the day after the premiere, right? Yeah. Amazing.
So I think the same this year. So it'll be a nice brand new film that no one's seen before. Very exciting.
Very exciting. Roberto, what are you looking forward to?
I'm going to just go straight forward. I'm going to say on Halloween, we've got a great double bill on Friday, the 31st of October at 12:30. If you are looking for some more family-friendly, spooky content, we have the original 1984 Ghostbusters.
Which great film.
It's still a classic.
Possibly my favourite. Great film.
Still really funny. Kind of dry. A lot's made about American humour being like more bombastic, but it's funny how dry the first Ghostbusters humor is, but anyway, absolute classic. I'm sure you know. Come and see it on the big screen. And then the evening at 7:30, An American Werewolf in London, another great horror comedy. That is, I watched for the first time a couple of years ago, and I absolutely loved it. It's absolutely as great as everyone says. And come to see probably still the best werewolf transformation in cinema history. I don't know if it's been beat.
Still scares me.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, great film. Come to see. So Halloween, come to the Odyssey.
Yeah, that's a good two, that is a good two. Nick, what are you excited about?
More spooky selections. So on Wednesday, 29th of October at 7:30, we have a little Shop of Horrors. This is the, I think it's 84, I'm not exactly sure, but the 80s musical comedy with a bit of a dark twist to it. It was involved with Frank Oz. He directed it, and he's been working with puppets with Jim Henson. So they've got a massive Seymour man-eating plant.
Moranis, who's also in Ghostbusters.
Yes, yeah.
Steve Martin is in it as well. Ellen Green is in the movie. If you've never seen it before, this is the place to catch it on the big screen there. It is an evening showing, but it is for family, so feel free to come along with the kids if they have nothing to do. And then the day after, Thursday the 30th at 7:30 as well, is a bit more of a modern spooky tale, which is The Long Walk. It's based on the Stephen King short story. Pretty simple tale, about 50-odd teenagers that walk for their lives, essentially, and then the last one wins riches of the unknown. It's directed by Francis Lawrence, who did a lot of the Hunger Games movies as well, so very much in that same vibe of, you know, children battling for their lives, essentially. But it has got some more atmospheric sort of storytelling in that of, like, I mean, what we see in society and how that can cross over into that sort of futuristic, you know,
dystopia.
Dystopia, yeah, exactly. It's a very good watch, and that's on Thursday the 30th at 7:30.
Excellent. So some cracking spooky films coming up for Halloween, as you'd expect. So that means then, chaps, there's only one thing left to do, just for thank everyone who listens to the podcast and say goodbye. I think we have to do it in our spookiest voices if we can. I'm going to start with Roberto in the middle.
Spooky voice, okay.
Thank you for watching the Podyssey. Goodbye.
I don't know why I went to Dr. Crook, but yeah.
Didn't
know,
did it, right? Nick, is that me next?
Okay, I'm going to do a campy one. Thank you for listening to the Podyssey.
Oh, that is exactly what I was about to do. Okay.
Do it again.
Thank you for listening to the Odyssey.
Thank you for listening to the Odyssey.
Right,
that's really good.
Thank you, chap. I was watching Nosferatu, and I feel like I'm not there. Right, say goodbye, chaps.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Thanks for listening. If you want to drop us a line here at the Podyssey, you can email me at neil.rodger@mix926.com with your thoughts on the show, your views on the films we've talked about, and if you're feeling brave, you could do our next intro or set our next final challenge. You can find out all about what's on at the Odyssey or what's going on with Mix 92.6 FM by checking out the websites and searching them on all the socials, where they can both be found.